2 days into the FBI's investigation into Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh, President Trump says it's going well and that he expects Kavanaugh to be confirmed once it wraps up.
The FBI, as you know, is all over talking to everybody. And I would expect he's a very high quality person. I would expect it's going to turn out very well for the judge.
Speaking to reporters as Marine One was warming up, he said the FBI investigation could be a blessing in disguise that exonerates Kavanaugh and embarrasses the Democrats. And he's hoping it'll also determine who leaked Christine Blasey Ford's confidential letter telling her story.
I'd like to find out who leaked the papers. Was it Senator Feinstein? Because certainly her body language was not exactly very good when they asked her that question.
The FBI investigation follows a deal between Republican Senator Jeff Flake and Democratic Senator Chris Coons, who both sit on the Senate Judiciary Committee. And last night on 60 Minutes, they spoke with Scott Pelley. Jeff Flake admits there are risks to this investigation.
If Judge Kavanaugh is shown to have lied to the committee, nomination's over?
Oh, yes. I would think so.
Senator Flake was also very open about the reason he was able to change his mind and push for an investigation.
Senator Flake, you've announced that you're not running for re-election, and I wonder, could you have done this if you were running for re-election?
No. Not a chance.
Not a chance.
No.
Because politics has become too sharp, too partisan?
Yeah, there's no value to reaching across the aisle. There's no currency for that anymore. There's no incentive.
But this isn't just about an unverified assault allegation. On CBS's Face the Nation, Minnesota Democratic Senator Amy Klobuchar says her main concern is that Kavanaugh, should he join the court, would have a tendency to defer to presidential power.
This isn't a criminal trial. This is a job interview for the highest court in the land. And my colleagues who are still undecided, that's not me, but my colleagues who are undecided are going to have to evaluate that temperament and evaluate his decisions from the past, which I think are extreme when it comes to presidential power.
As for how Senator Dianne Feinstein, the ranking member of the Judiciary Committee, handled what was supposed to be a confidential letter from Professor Ford.
There may have been better ways to handle this. The question is, when you have power, what do you do with that information? Do you just sweep it under the rug and say, well, what happened in a house doesn't belong in the courthouse? No, you look at it. You don't sweep it under the rug.
On CBS's Face the Nation, Arkansas Republican Senator Tom Cotton had a very different view. He says the Democrats and Professor Ford's lawyers have a lot to answer for.
They pointed her to lawyers who lied to her and did not tell her that the committee staff was willing to go to California to interview her. All that's water under the bridge. Those lawyers are going to have to face a D.C. bar investigation and their misconduct. Dianne Feinstein and her staff is going to face an investigation for why they leaked that. There is a well-established process of confidentiality on the committee. Dianne Feinstein could have showed that letter to Chuck Grassley, and the two of them, as the leaders of that committee, could have shared it with the FBI, who could have discreetly conducted this inquiry in July and in August without betraying Ms. Ford's confidences.
Senator Feinstein has denied that she or her staff leaked Dr. Ford's identity. It was a reporter for The Intercept who first published a story alleging that Democrats were withholding a, quote, letter from a California constituent that was accusing Kavanaugh. Lindsey Graham says that needs to be investigated, too.
I'm going to call for an investigation of what happened in this committee, who betrayed Dr. Ford's trust, who in Feinstein's office recommended Katz as a lawyer. Why did Ms. Ford not know that the committee was willing to go to California?
Deborah Katz, the lawyer who represented Professor Ford, has represented a number of Me Too cases and has described herself as part of the anti-Trump resistance. Quick follow-up here. You remember the president's decision to meet with Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein? That meeting could be delayed again. White House spokesperson Sarah Sanders told Fox News Sunday that she could see the meeting pushing back another week, as she put it.
A date for that hasn't been set. It could be this week. I could see it pushing back another week, given all of the other things that are going on with the Supreme Court.
Rosenstein's job may be in question following reports that he discussed possibly secretly recording President Trump and invoking the Constitution's 25th Amendment to remove him from office. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. Good to have you tuned in. Brooke Coleman is professor of law at Seattle University and a procedural justice expert. And Brooke, I thought, I guess the thing that's most shocking to me about the whole Kavanaugh thing is that I thought we had given the green light to report this kind of thing and pursue these kind of allegations back in the Anita Hill days. And now it's becoming clear that a lot of people have still kept this to themselves. So how do you think this changes that, if at all?
Yeah, I have this concern because one of the things that we saw after the Anita Hill hearings was a better understanding of how sexual harassment works and how we might address it in the workplace. But it's clear that we still haven't done enough to make people feel comfortable enough to come forward with what's happened to them at the time that it's happened, and we can see the issues that that causes. Watching someone like Dr. Ford testify and seeing that maybe even though she was credible and believable, but yet he still may be confirmed as a Supreme Court justice, I wonder what impact that's going to have on women reporting going forward. My hope is that there'll be more reporting because people feel like maybe something's going to change in the wake of this. But it is a major concern that those of us who care about the reporting of sexual harassment and sexual assault have, that when we see that our allegations aren't taken seriously, then why would women report in the first place?
And I think the Kavanaugh supporters are upset because there is no proof. She has no proof. That's what you constantly hear. And there's a worry that Kavanaugh's due process is being violated here. So what do you think about that?
Well, I think there's two things. First, I'll take the due process part. I mean, the bottom line is this isn't a court of law. This isn't a civil hearing. This isn't a criminal hearing. This is a job interview. It's not exactly perfectly a job interview, obviously, because it's a job interview for a major position, a lifetime appointment to a court. But it is basically like a job interview. And, you know, just like any other job interview, the folks interviewing you can take everything into account, including your demeanor and your ability to talk about things in a way that doesn't equivocate and whether or not you have some kind of judicial temperament. So those are all things that they can take into account. As far as the no proof part, I'm not sure what else we can do. I mean, I know that the FBI investigation is happening again, but I'm not sure what it would take for the Judiciary Committee to feel like her allegations are corroborated, short of a judge saying that he actually witnessed it, which then, again, calls into question that the only way we're going to believe women if there's a man there to corroborate what happened to her. I have real concerns about that. There is not any proof, but there's also not any proof that it didn't happen. And every study that we've done on the reporting of sexual assault or sexual harassment shows that false accusations and false reports are definitely in the very, very high minority. It's not something that happens very often. So I wonder why we have this presumption that we shouldn't believe women, when in fact, I think we should.
Yeah, it's hard to I can't figure out any reason why she would make this up. I don't see what you gain by that. But I mean, there have been famous cases like the Duke lacrosse case where somebody did make it up. So what's the balance here? For example, should there be a penalty if in the event it's proven someone made one of these things up? Should there be a penalty for that?
Well, I'm sure. I mean, she could sue if it turns out that what she did was false and what she said was false. There are all kinds of civil actions that people could take against, that Kavanaugh could take against her. Defamation is one thing that comes to mind right away. She's also testified under oath, so she would be subject to any charges of perjury. I mean, they've all been talking to FBI agents and making reportings. There's all kinds of criminal penalties there for lying to FBI agents. I mean, these are things that have gotten some people in the Trump administration in trouble because they've lied to the FBI during those investigations. So there's a huge amount of risk, and I think you're right. The idea that someone would make something like this up is something that I think should give us pause. And remember also that since Clarence Thomas, we've approved a number of federal judges and a handful of Supreme Court justices, and yet these kinds of allegations have not arisen. And most recently with Judge Gorsuch, which was a conservative nominee, and none of these kinds of allegations arose against him. So while we're trying to make this into a partisan ideological issue as a society, it really isn't. It's an issue that we should be worrying about. The fact that women are subject to sexual assault and sexual harassment in many aspects of their life, and we're hearing now that almost every woman that we know has a story, is what we should all be unified in our concern about instead of worrying about the political aspects of it. Unfortunately, as we've all seen, that's not how this has turned out.
And a refrain I keep hearing from Kavanaugh backers, too, is that Me Too has gone too far, and I cannot find a corner in that argument that I believe about it going too far, because you look at the Me Too accusations, when have they been wrong? Nobody's been falsely accused yet because of Me Too.
I think the other thing that I worry about, too, is that the folks who have borne the consequences of the Me Too movement, if we set aside for the moment that obviously women who have reported are the ones who are bearing the largest consequences because they've lived through it and now they're living through the reporting. But if our concern is that men are losing their jobs and things like that are happening, I understand that. But when we look at the consequences that have been borne by men, it has been mostly men in Hollywood or men like Al Franken. We've really yet to see, I mean, there have been a handful of quote-unquote conservative or Republican men who've borne the consequences, but not that many. And again, I would just say this isn't an ideological issue. And the chance of Me Too going too far, I'm sure, is definitely something that could happen, but I think we've got a long way to go before we get there. There are plenty of other constraints on people making these kinds of accusations. And obviously, you know, the way we started this conversation is how many women are watching Dr. Ford and thinking, wow, I might have come forward even if I had accusations against Kavanaugh or anyone else, but maybe now I won't, because that just looks like no fun at all.
Right.
And one thing we haven't asked you, I'd be curious, as a law professor, what did you see in in the Kavanaugh response to this? Was there anything that you, I mean, do you think he did a good job? Do you think he convicted himself? I mean, what did you think?
I think the biggest concern I have about the Kavanaugh response is that this is a person who's going to serve on the Supreme Court of the United States. And for better or for worse, you know, we tend to think of the Supreme Court as this ideological body, but then at the same time, we all love the fact that they all kind of remain nonpartisan. And so to see him invoke Democrats and this partisan kind of language that he chose to use, and then also getting so angry and losing his temper the way he did, he just basically did not show judicial temperament. It's just not something, if you would have watched those hearings without knowing whether Dr. Ford or Judge Kavanaugh were the ones up as a Supreme Court justice, you wouldn't have thought that Judge Kavanaugh was the one who was up for that position. Her demeanor was much more judicial, and her temperament was much better. And I think that also is something for us to think about from a gender perspective. Had she behaved the way that Judge Kavanaugh did, I'm not sure many of the senators would have said that she was credible. Yet Judge Kavanaugh is allowed to behave the way he is, and many people are saying that he was credible. And I just have a hard time that juxtaposition should not be lost on anyone, that she had a much higher standard of behavior than he did.
Brooke Coleman, professor of law, Seattle University. Brooke, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Turns out last Thursday was a bonding experience for the country of sorts. 20 million Americans tuned in to watch Dr. Christine Blasey Ford lay out her allegations against Judge Brett Kavanaugh. She came across as pretty composed. I think the surprise was the way Judge Kavanaugh came out firing.
This whole two-week effort has been a calculated and orchestrated political hit, fueled with apparent pent-up anger about President Trump and the 2016 election, fear that has been unfairly stoked about my judicial record, revenge on behalf of the Clintons, and millions of dollars in money from outside left-wing opposition groups. This is a circus.
And whatever you think about the allegations, there were certainly some people who thought that the judicial demeanor was broken during that testimony. Let's talk to Professor Ronald Collins, the Howard Scheffelman Scholar at the University of Washington Law School. Did you see anything concerning about his testimony, Professor?
Well, the whole procedure was just virtually unprecedented. It was bizarre in many respects on both sides of the aisle, and the testimony given. I think the only person that retained their calm and demeanor and remained judicious was the person who was first testifying, that is Professor Ford.
This is the question that came up during the talk shows. Is if you are innocent of something like that, what approach should you take? How are you expected to feel? And I heard people weigh in on both sides, some saying that, yeah, if I was falsely accused like that, I'd be outraged, I'd be pained, I'd be sad for my family, and others who said that he should have been more composed. So I guess, did you see anything in that testimony itself that you would consider disqualifying for a Supreme Court justice?
Well, first, in terms of your first point, how one responds, it depends on what has actually transpired. So obviously that affects things. I think that the judge could have been firm and measured and thereby avoided any claims that he was not being judicious or that he didn't have the appropriate temperament. But, you know, in all of this, at the end of the day, really, what matters most is not any particular procedure, any particular law, or any particular investigation. What matters most at this pinpoint in time is time itself. That is, the more the clock ticks, the more this nomination is in serious jeopardy.
Because of what? The danger of other people coming forward?
Well, the thing is that there's, first of all, there's news stories, kind of comparisons between what he said and she said. There's also the possibility of new witnesses, which are new testimony or new claims of either assaults or him lying or his drinking habits. So the clock here is really what's most important. And that is why probably the White House strategy is to complete this investigation as soon as possible. Maybe even within a few days. After all, the White House controls the scope of this investigation.
Right.
At this point, although it's unclear, it looks like there are only going to be four or five witnesses that are interrogated. The judge's drinking history has already been deemed to be outside of the scope of investigation. And when this report is all done, and it may be done by Tuesday or Wednesday, remember that it goes to Don McGahn at the White House for a review on how to proceed. Thereafter, a call for procedural votes in the Senate could happen as early as Friday.
So you think this is for show?
Well, you know, it's a dangerous show. It's a very dangerous thing. The thing is that if you let the clock run too long, more damaging evidence can come out. If you move it too quickly, then the question is, will it be seen as a sham? Because remember, at the end of the day, there's only three votes that matter, all right? The three senators. Collins, Flake, and Murkowski. Those are the only votes. And the question is, how much pressure will be put on them? Remember that this whole, more than anything else, the greatest constitutional moment that we've seen hasn't come from the Senate, hasn't come from the testimony that was offered. It came from the two women who confronted Senator Flake in the elevator.
That's right.
That was the game changer. And you see, that sort of thing very much affected the mood of the country and the three senators. So at the end of the day, the question is, will the White House move too fast in a way that it's detrimental, or will they let the clock run too long, which is also detrimental? So I think it's fair to say that the good judge, or I should say the judge, is between a rock and a hard place in all of this.
Right. Okay. So how do you think this kind of job interview should be handled? Is there a better way to do this? Because this has happened, of course, not just to Kavanaugh, but to a number of highly placed people. And I can see, certainly among Lindsey Graham's, in Lindsey Graham's statement, a little fretting that we are moving based on evidence that is uncorroborated. We are making judgments based on who we think comes across as the most sincere on television. As somebody who has spent a career steeped in the law, is this a good way to proceed?
Well, the Senator Lindsey Graham's comments, on the one hand, did carry some merit. On the other hand, they were not without irony. I mean, after all, one of the reasons the Democrats are proceeding the way they are is because of what happened to Judge Merrick Garland. All right, that was unprecedented as well. All of this traces back to Judge Bork and his confirmation proceedings. And ever since then, we've entered a new highly partisan nomination reality. That is, the name of the game is evade, evade, evade. And basically, this kind of invites partisan conflicts on both sides of the aisle. Until you see people like Senator Flake and others come together and come back to what has become a dirty word, namely compromise. Until that happens, we're really not going to see any significant changes in this whole process. And by the way, even if Judge Kavanaugh is confirmed, let us just say that that happens and he takes the seat on the court, which begins today, the new term begins today. If the Democrats take the House, it's entirely possible that impeachment proceedings will begin against him and that this whole nightmarish scenario will continue. Moreover, think about what this means for Dr. Ford and the whole question about sexual aggression and what have you. This is a wound that hasn't been healed. If anything, it's more of an issue today than it's ever been. And so not only is the law, if you will, of judicial nominations very much up for grabs, but also the whole question of sexual aggression and how we as a nation respond to it is also very much a part of this new day in America.
Professor Ronald Collins is the Howard Scheffelman Scholar at the University of Washington School of Law. Thanks for getting up early. I appreciate it.
Happy to do it. Be well.
Ceremony still going on in the Rose Garden. President has made his remarks on the new trade deal. Goodbye, NAFTA. Hello, U.S.-Mexico-Canada trade agreement. We called up CBS senior business analyst Jill Schlesinger, who has gotten a look at the deal.
We didn't rip up NAFTA, just to be clear. Let's just call this, instead of calling it NAFTA 2.0, the administration calls it the U.S.-Mexico-Canada Agreement, or USMCA. I don't know. It's really hard to say that.
Rolls right off the tongue.
Yeah, exactly. So, look, what's the big news here? This is essentially the agreement that the United States and Mexico had back at the end of August. And the way that that deal was negotiated was that it reformed NAFTA such that any of the three countries, the United States, Mexico, and now Canada, would agree to new rules that require 75% of auto content, meaning the car, but also everything in it, had to be made in the U.S., Mexico, and Canada. And that was up from the previous level of 62.5%. So now more of the car has to be made in the NAFTA region. And it's meant to ensure that not just that the cars are being built in the region, but it makes it a bit harder for countries like China to kind of sidestep the rules and push cheap products through Mexico, which then find their way into the United States. So one part, more of the car has to be made in the NAFTA region. Also, it forces 40 to 45% of autos and components to be made by workers earning at least $16 per hour. Now, what's that meant to do? It's supposed to limit the number of U.S. companies that send manufacturing jobs to lower wage Mexican facilities. And I should also note there would also be new rights extended to Mexican labor unions. Those are the two big parts of the deal. It's an initial 16-year term with an option to revisit issues in 6 years and then extend for another 16 years beyond that.
Well, that sounds like pretty good news, then. It sounds like you have not only created jobs for people, but also required a minimum pay level.
Right. And I think that although I know that most people don't necessarily focus on this, I actually think it could be good for Mexican workers because, you know, essentially, if you're making more money than you previously were, then that is certainly good news. And by the way, a lot of the companies here in the United States pay more than $16 an hour.
Right.
So it still may be cheaper to send your job to Mexico at 16. One thing that was kind of interesting is that some critics have said that this is putting new regulations on companies that do business in the region. And there could be a shift to more production in Asia. I don't know. We'll have to see how it plays out. We also know that one of the last minute concessions that got Canada in the deal on both sides, Canada said, okay, we are not going to have as draconian protection of our own dairy industry. So Canada right. gave on that. And the U.S. actually gave on the idea that it wanted to get rid of the original treaty's special courts that would challenge trade restrictions. So both sides gave up something to get on board the deal. You know, in essence, we know that NAFTA, which went into effect in 1994, was certainly not perfect. There are some improvements being made here, but this is not exactly a brand new agreement. It is a slight improvement over the previous deal.
But does this mean that we can look forward to wage gains in this country now?
Well, we may be having wage gains not for this reason. I think that the wage gains that are coming and have been happening over the course of the year have occurred because the economy is doing better. And that is good news. And, you know, I don't think there's any way around that. We're seeing about 3% growth here in the U.S. That's great. The little issue that alongside that growth is that prices are rising also. So we're just right now seeing wage growth at around 2.9% from a year ago. We'll get new numbers on Friday. And that's just 0.2 ahead of the inflation rate. So what does that mean? It means that when you hear someone like me say wage gains, that's so great, and you feel like, I don't feel that much richer, probably it's because of prices rising in general.
Now, any news on the deal with China, and are we indeed going to see prices for everything made in China go up?
Well, you know, it's funny because if you look at the culmination of this deal, the NAFTA 2.0, which sounds a lot better than whatever thing they've made up, we got a revised free trade agreement with South Korea. We got the launch of new trade talks with Japan, but kind of radio silence when it comes to China. So the Chinese problem still exists. That will keep a bit of a dark cloud on the horizon. But, you know, for this morning, I think if you look at just the market reaction, it's, hey, markets don't like uncertainty. Investors want to see deals be made. Investors like the idea of cross-country trading because it's good for every company. It may not be great for workers. I'm just saying that's what the investment community likes. And I think we'll see some new records today on the Dow and the S&P 500 as a result.
CBS Senior Business Analyst Jill Schlesinger. Thank you, Jill.
Take care.
The FBI investigation of allegations against Brett Kavanaugh is underway. The question is, can you do that in just 7 days? To help us answer that, we have on the line retired FBI agent David Gomez, who spent 28 years with the FBI, during which time he served as the senior assistant special agent in charge for the FBI Seattle field office. So, David, the FBI has been told you got 7 days to figure out who's telling the truth about something that happened 36 years ago. Is that possible?
Well, you've got, Dave, thanks for having me on. You've got 10,000 agents in the FBI spread across all of the United States, so I certainly think it's within the realm of possibility. What actually happens is the FBI headquarters sets out those leads to the offices closest to wherever the person to be interviewed lives, and then that office will designate however many agents are needed to locate and interview that person within 24 hours.
Now, it was pointed out during the confirmation hearings that Judge Kavanaugh has already undergone numerous background checks, and this never came up. What's the difference between a background check and what's going on now?
Well, this is involving very specific allegations made by Dr. Ford during the hearings, in addition to other allegations, similar type allegations being made by additional people. The Senate requested this of the president, since the FBI works for the executive branch. The Senate really can't direct the FBI. They need the president's concurrence. And the president concurred that the allegations needed to be fleshed out. A normal background investigation looks at the issues of character, loyalty, alcohol abuse, ability to do the job, biases, and drug abuse. So this is just going to be a little more expansive and a little more pointed in their interviews of these four specific individuals and anyone else that turns up in the investigation that also needs to be interviewed.
When you were an active FBI agent, what did you learn about memory? Because I was reading James Comey's op-ed in the New York Times today. He says, FBI agents know that time has very little to do with memory. You know, every married person remembers the weather on their wedding day, no matter how long ago. So, I mean, the thing that's frustrating to people is you have two people under oath, there are consequences to lying, and yet one person remembers it like it was yesterday, and the other person says, it never happened. Did you experience this kind of thing when you were investigating stuff like this?
Well, yes. Long-term memory is one of those difficult things to evaluate, which is why you cannot just rely on the statements of one individual saying, yes, this occurred. Clearly, in this situation, I think someone is, well, they could both be telling the truth, but from different perspectives. But that's why it's important to not only get the perspective of the person making the allegation in these cases, but also to get reference points of other people who may or may not have information relevant to the memory issue.
Comey also writes, little lies point to bigger lies. The obvious lies by Kavanaugh about the meaning of words in a yearbook are a flashing signal to dig deeper. Did you watch the hearing? Do you agree with that?
I did not watch the hearings live. I did see that some of those particular statements in recorded news broadcasts. Yeah, I think that the little lies lead to big lies, and I think that that's going to be a problem for Judge Kavanaugh if the FBI is allowed to explore those particular issues in depth with other people. I think from my own personal experience, you know, in high school, that there were some an attempt to manipulate the perception of what certain words meant in certain instances may have meant. So that could be an issue. But it really depends on whether the president will authorize expansion into those particular areas.
Is a week enough?
A week is enough to get all this done based on what was asked for at the beginning of the week. Should additional information come up, that will be presented in the report as something that needs to be fleshed out, and then the issue will be, will they be given additional time to contact and interview those individuals as well?
And again, there are considerable legal consequences should any of the witnesses lie to the FBI agents, correct?
That's correct. A material false statement to the FBI is prosecutable under Section 18 U.S.C. 1001. False statements.
Because one of the things that was mentioned mostly by the Republicans was, what's the point of sending out agents to investigate, for example, Mark Judge, when he has already said that he doesn't have any memory of this and in any case doesn't want to talk about it? Does it make a difference when... Is there signing a statement in front of a lawyer and having two FBI agents in your apartment?
I think it makes a big difference because the lawyer is talking on behalf of Mark Judge and is going to represent what he wants him to say. Mark Judge hasn't been confronted in his statements by anyone. They're sending out their best investigators to conduct this. And I know that the Washington field office has very senior individuals on their background squad that are capable of doing this kind of interview. He's going to be presented with conflicting statements, and he's going to be asked to clarify, and he's going to be asked to provide other references that may be able to provide insight into his denials.
Yeah. Does he now, if it turns out he was there and just stood by, could this morph into a prosecution of him?
No, not at all. I don't think that this has anything to do with prosecution. It's about character. And so he doesn't have anything to fear from his statements other than his reputation. And
what about Kavanaugh himself? I heard some, I can't remember where, quite frankly, maybe I'm wrong about this, but that in Maryland there would be no statute of limitations on this, and that technically Kavanaugh could be prosecuted. Could that happen?
Well, technically... Well, I'm not an expert on Maryland law, but that's certainly a possibility. But I actually didn't hear anything in the allegations that would lead to a reasonable prosecution almost anywhere. A zealous prosecutor can bring charges, doesn't mean that they're going to be convicted.
Yeah. So what can we rationally expect to be in that FBI report?
Well, the FBI report is actually just a compilation of the interviews as addendums or annexes to the report. The report will simply summarize the statements of those individuals. Mm-hmm. It doesn't come to any conclusions, and it makes no recommendations whatsoever.
So it'll just be raw statements from them, but these are statements which have been given on pain of prosecution if you lie to a couple of FBI agents looking very official appearing in person.
Yeah, that's correct. The actual forms, the FD-302 that the interview is recorded on, will be provided to the White House along with a detailed summary of the interview contents, but again, no recommendations or conclusions.
David Gomez, 28 years with the FBI and senior assistant special agent in charge, served as senior assistant special agent in charge of the FBI Seattle field office. David, thank you very much for coming on this morning.
Thank you very much, Dave.
We've told you about the gun control initiative that'll be on the ballot. That's one, 1639. Seattle has a new safe storage law. That's gun law number two. And now King County has its own gun control proposals. That's number three. That's going to spread the NRA pretty thin, Hannah. So tell us what's in the King County proposal here.
Okay. So the King County Council is expected to vote today on what it's calling a proposed safety gun safety action plan. So this is four gun safety measures proposed by council members Jeannie Cole Wells and Joe McDermott that cover a whole lot of ground. McDermott says the overall theme here is to treat gun violence like the public health crisis he says it is.
Over 35,000 people are killed every year, victims of gun violence across our country, and it's something we need to respond to in a public health crisis, much like we have tobacco use and vehicular deaths. This is a start at doing this. No single piece of legislation, no single package will solve the problem, but we have to start taking incremental steps toward that solution.
So the four proposals include the creation of a firearm safety task force within public health to come up with ways to prevent deaths and injuries from guns, specifically focused on intervention and prevention. McDermott says the legislation also requires the sheriff's office to destroy all guns it takes from criminals rather than resell them.
There's no reason why we need more firearms out on the streets. If a firearm is forfeited, seized and forfeited legally, the policy of the last at least three sheriffs has been to destroy those firearms, and we want to encode that in county ordinance.
Now, among the more interesting proposals is the third one, which commissions a youth-led report on gun violence.
Whether it's crime or mass shootings, or whether it's a gang shooting, or whether it's suicide, it is important to be talking to youth. They experience this, and they experience it in their schools, on their streets, in their neighborhoods, in their communities, and to hear from them and make sure that we're not just adults coming up with solutions that we think are going to work, but taking solutions advanced by youth and implementing them, I think is going to be essential in one of those prongs of approach to the public health crisis.
And the fourth part of this proposal is safe storage.
The recent study showed that 21% of adults in Washington, one in five, report having a gun in or around their home. And of those owners, almost half reported these firearms were stored unlocked, and 15% reported they were stored unlocked and loaded.
So unlike Seattle's law, this would allow for trigger locks in addition to safes or cabinets for you to lock your weapon. It requires whether your weapon is loaded or unloaded, it has to be locked up inside the home. It was originally set to be a criminal penalty. They backtracked on that in committee, so it's now just a civil penalty. It starts with a warning, goes up to a $10,000 fine, depending on what the circumstances are.
So how would King County enforce this law?
It's, again, it's not like they're coming and knocking on your doors and seeing if your guns are locked up. What happens here is if it can be any number of things, right? So if there's a child in the home that gets a hold of the gun, takes it to school, uses it or doesn't use it, gets caught with it, or takes their own life.
So there's got to be a precipitating incident of some kind, as with the Seattle law.
Yeah, absolutely.
And then if your gun is found being used for the wrong purpose, they're going to go back and say, did you store it responsibly?
Yes.
And then you could get a fine if you didn't start responsibly.
Yes. Yeah.
And what about the battle against laws like this? Because I know in my own experience, when somebody tried to break into my home when I was living in Spokane, what I remember in the panic of the moment is my gun has a trigger lock. I couldn't remember the number, right? And that's the argument for many gun owners, is that I need it in case of an emergency and I need quick access to it. So what's the argument against?
What you just said, that is the argument against. There are gun owners who would always tell you that they are responsible with their own weapons. They know when it needs to be locked up, when it doesn't. Most gun owners, Dave Workman, will tell you, do safely store their weapon somehow. There are trigger locks that are biometric now. You can use a fingerprint. I think they're fairly expensive.
And are they reliable now, Dave? I know you've followed the biometric ones.
There have been several developed. I don't know. I haven't heard anybody say, I love the fingerprint thing, because it's like your iPhone. Sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. And the last thing
your
want
is your fingers wet. It doesn't.
Right.
Absolutely. So I don't think anyone who's proposing these laws, whether you're talking 1639, City of Seattle, or King County, I don't think they care about those arguments. They want these to be kept out of the hands of kids who take their own lives, thieves who take them and use them in a crime, at carjack someone, murder somebody, things like that. They say this should be...
But there's no problem if you have the gun locked and loaded while you are there. right?
Right. If you're in the house, that's fine.
I mean, so
it's when you leave the house.
Right. Nothing in these laws says you can't have a loaded gun sitting on your night table. It's just that when you don't leave it there when you go. You know, it's like you put things, you know, you put things away to keep your house
tidy. And I get the nightly routine. Brush your teeth, take out your gun.
It comes down to access, right, though, right? Because if your kid, your toddler, comes out of the room next door and sneaks into your room when it's there and gets it, you're still going to face a fine for that.
Yeah.
Now, I should point out, Seattle already facing a lawsuit from the NRA, Second Amendment Foundation, because of its safe storage. County is expected to also face a lawsuit should that happen. McDermott's not concerned about that. Or state preemption, as we know, which bans cities and cities and counties from enacting their own laws that are any stricter than the state law. So that's what those lawsuits would be about. McDermott is not concerned with that. And he says until the state legislature acts on its own, then it's up to the cities and counties to make these laws. He is actually pushing for the state legislature to just get out of the way and repeal state preemption. Good luck with that. We'll see. And then if that happens, though, the idea here on the county gun safety action plan is to then proceed with the proposals for raising the age to 21 for semi-automatic weapons, more background checks, things like that, like we see in 1639. So,
yeah. All right. It's Hannah Scott. Thank you, Hannah.
You bet.
And now, it's time for our Sports Insider from 710 ESPN Seattle, brought to you by your Western Washington Toyota dealers. Here he is, Seattle's middle finger specialist, Danny O'Neill. Before we get to that, though, the Huskies, they're number 10.
Yeah.
Now, BYU's, this is what you'd consider a real team, right?
Yeah, they're a ranked opponent. They came in here, they defeated number 6 Wisconsin on the road. So, yeah, they had some bona fides. And they came in here and they got whooped.
Whooped.
Yeah, Washington put it to them.
Put it to them. Pinned their ears back.
Up 35-0. Jake Browning had a phenomenal day. Yeah, showed them what's what.
Let him have a few points at the end there.
Yeah, that was off of a fumbled punt. That was disappointing. Could have given him a shut him out. Hung a bagel on him.
So here's the big question: given what's been happening to the Seahawks, could the Huskies sort of take their place in Seattle's heart?
It was what this season began with, that question. And I don't know. There is regional differences because there's a chunk of Seattle's population that's not really going to identify with the University of Washington necessarily because they didn't go to school there. Some of them are going to actually actively dislike the University of Washington, such as one Chris Sullivan. They might have regional differences that
are
there or
went
to Washington State.
I will next week.
Yeah, but so I don't know the answer to that question. Certainly in the early 90s, the Huskies were the best team in town. It was the hottest thing going.
I remember that.
So will it get back to that? It could. It certainly could. We'll see. As long as the Seahawks keep winning, though, and the Seahawks remain relevant, and you certainly look at the TV ratings, and the Seahawks have not lost any of the... They might have lost some of the swagger, some of the glamour, but they haven't. People have not stopped watching them locally.
2-2, they were able to tie up their record. And...
Yeah, that was not a great win, though. That was tough. On the road, they almost lost to a winless team that was starting a rookie quarterback, and you had one of the best players in franchise history leave the field and express some frustration and anger toward the team that employs him.
Yeah,
so,
let's talk about that.
Yeah, not a great day. Earl Thomas suffered for what, all intents and purposes, appears to be a season-ending broken leg. Exactly the kind of injury that precipitated his desire for a contract extension. And in the sort of, it's almost like this perverse turn, it also justifies Seattle's decision not to give it to him, right? Is that sort of injury to a player can change everything and the complexion of everything going forward. And he obviously felt very raw about the fact that he had suffered an injury, that he knew what the injury was. And as he was carted off, extended a middle finger in the direction of Seattle's sideline. Not sure who it was. As Pete Carroll pointed out, it was a big sideline, a big stadium.
so
you're not sure exactly who it was, but he certainly leaves with some very, very hard feelings. And that's probably, almost certainly, his last game as a Seahawk.
And there's a lot of talk about this middle finger. Are people more upset that he gave the middle finger, or are they upset this is the way he left? I mean, what are they upset about? Because I don't get Pearl clutching over a middle finger. He was obviously upset. These are athletes working at a very high, intense level. Or is it just disappointment that he would do something like this?
It's anger that he's angry at the team.
What?
And that the fact that he went into an opponent's locker room after a victory last year and said, if you get a chance, come get me to the Cowboys, that he held out and didn't participate, that he didn't practice a couple weeks ago and said afterward that, hey, if I had a contract extension, fans are fans of the team. And so you end up rooting for and wanting teams to make decisions in their own best self-interest. And
we forget about the person when we think only of the team.
Yeah. Yes. That's what fans are. And fans root for the team. And they're fans of Earl Thomas as long as Earl Thomas's interests align with the team. And that gets exposed. And a lot of times that's really hard for a player to hear or to understand, mm-hmm. is that they ultimately want success for their team, not just success for the players.
So what's ahead for him? I know his anger was expressed at the Seahawks, but do other teams look at that and say, this looks like trouble to me?
Certainly doesn't make a team more willing to employ him. No. I don't think anybody looks at it and says he should be healthy by about the Super Bowl. He should be healthy by the time, and really the important date is March when he'll be a free agent. And he'll be free to negotiate with other teams so long as Seattle doesn't apply the franchise tag to him, which is almost certain that they would not. And he will try to sell someone on the fact that he's got 3 to 4 years of really high-level football left, though he'll be turning 30 before this next season.
Mm. Well, as one sports writer wrote, this is the worst possible end to this whole incident.
Well, yes, it's really sad. I mean, and that's what I felt was sad, that it's going to end this way and that these players who have achieved so much, Sherm and Earl and Cam Chancellor, it's all coming to an end. And you're seeing that the exits are not always graceful and that there's a lot of hostility, and that's sad. But I think that eventually everybody, they will feel better about what they helped this team and this town achieve. But yeah, there's a little bit of sorrow. It's the worst possible ending from Thomas's perspective. Right. He also did get paid $50 million, in excess of $50 million over the 9 seasons that he's played
that's
here.
Not too bad.
So it hasn't been that he was exploited, but he probably leaves feeling like I'm the tube of toothpaste that they squeezed all that $50 million out of and then were willing to discard me. So yeah, I feel sad. I feel bad for him.
Sports Insider brought to you by your Western Washington Toyota dealers. Thanks, Danny.
You bet. Talk to you soon.
This is Seattle's Morning News. We're expecting a pretty cloudy week. Turns out, though, a cloudy day doesn't just reduce the output of your solar panels. It can actually affect your metabolism. Let's consult with the doctor.
Agent Dr. Cohen.
Dr. Gordon Cohen, M.D., so usually I would figure that the body would automatically compensate for the shorter days during the fall. But for some people, this can be a real problem.
There's a condition called seasonal affective disorder that is related to the amount of sunlight that you're exposed to. And it affects about 3 million Americans every year. And seasonal affective disorder, it's a type of depression. It's actually a depressive state that's related to the changes in seasons. And so it's not just a mentally depressed state, but it's actually a physiologically depressed state as well. So for some people, what happens is that their metabolism can fall and they become depressed. What people who have seasonal affective disorder note is that they actually feel depressed as the days become shorter and as there is less and less sunlight that they're exposed to. And it usually, for most people, starts in the fall and continues into the winter months. And it really makes people feel like they're sapped of their energy. Mm-hmm. And some people actually even get suicidal ideation. So yeah. It can be very, very impactful for people who actually have it.
So do the hats work? The hats with the special light lids?
So light therapy is one of the treatments. It's also called phototherapy. So here's the thing. What happens, and one of the causes of it, is that sunlight has light in specific wavelengths that then hits the back of your retina and causes the release of chemicals called melanocortins. And when that happens, you have, you know, more melatonin in your brain and you have more serotonin in your brain and you actually remain in a more positive state. But when there's inadequate sunlight, if you're susceptible and you don't have that light in the right wavelength, your levels of serotonin in your brain will fall, and that's associated with depression. But the thing is about phototherapy is it's a specialized light. It's not actually very expensive, and you don't have to do anything special other than put it in your vicinity. So light therapy actually mimics kind of the natural outdoor light, and it really appears, based on studies that have been done, to cause a change in brain chemicals that are linked to mood.
Yeah. Of course, a week in Hawaii sounds like it'd be a pretty good idea, too. Is that enough to sort of break the spell?
Sure. That's every doctor is going to recommend a week in Hawaii. The problem is that when you come back from Hawaii and you're exposed to the Seattle gray, you're at risk.
Even worse,
of getting,
huh?
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's a real thing. It's not an illusion. Is this something you need to see a doctor for, or can you pretty much just take some of the advice that you just gave and fix it yourself?
You need to take the signs and symptoms of seasonal affective disorder seriously. So as with any other type of depression, seasonal affective disorder could get worse, and it can really lead to problems if it's not treated. So I think the things that people need to look out for and be concerned about, and these are the things where that you need to recognize when it's time to see the doctor, are social withdrawal, school or work problems, substance abuse, or suicidal thoughts or behavior. Those are the things, the complications that you need to worry about, and if you're experiencing those, go and see your doctor because you may need more intensive therapy.
Yeah. Well, it's challenging in this area because the days do get really short and we're just getting into that phase right now. Plus it gets rainy. Plus the traffic gets worse. So you have a lot of things that sort of coincide this time of year.
Yeah, there are. And despite the bad weather, though, there are things that you can do that don't involve light and that don't involve medication. And so exercising regularly actually helps a lot of people, and there are numerous studies that have shown that. So exercise tends to boost your endorphins, it boosts your serotonin levels, it boosts your dopamine levels, so it can help to combat the effects of the seasonal affective disorder and create more balance. So exercise can be a really important part of it. And actually being outside, because there's still sunlight, so being outside more, even if it's rainy, even if it's cloudy, it can still help some. But
so in other words, if you have a walking routine, stick with it through the winter because it'll do you some good?
Yeah, absolutely stick with it. I mean, really, you need to create a plan of that you can stick to, whatever the treatment plan is, whether it's a combination of being outside, even in the bad weather, creating an exercise plan for yourself, using a satellite, a combination of all those things can, in many cases, keep people away from having to take medications. And importantly, it will help to elevate your metabolism so that you're not susceptible to the weight loss and slowing of metabolism that occurs with seasonal affective disorder.
Yeah. So for people who are about to spend their first winter in the Seattle area, because you've moved here from California to work for Amazon or Microsoft or wherever, be ready because it's real.
Yeah, it is real, and people do feel it. And I actually think that people come here and they say, gosh, I really don't like Seattle despite it being so beautiful because of the weather. But I think in many cases what they're really experiencing is they actually feel depressed during the winter months and they feel like they're not as active. And they're probably having some degree of seasonal affective disorder.
Dr. Gordon Cohen, MD. Dr. Cohen, thank you.
Thanks, Dave.